Well, hi, this is Phil Migliorati, and I'm on the line with Fred Vail, someone that all Beach Boy fans know very well, but we're hoping to get to know him a little bit better. Fred, thanks for joining me today.
Great, Phil. Glad to be on board. It's been a trial and error, hit and miss for us the last few weeks, but we finally got on the same wavelength.
Yes, and thanks for your patience and persistence on that. And we are at the maybe not quite the halfway mark through the Beach Boys 50th anniversary tour. And I've had an opportunity to see one of their shows. I don't know if you've had that opportunity yet, Fred.
Well, believe it or not, I have not. But I've certainly seen them enough times over the years and from the very beginnings almost. And I do plan on joining them. In fact, I may go to Cincinnati tomorrow as we speak. It's Monday the 11th. They're going to be in Cincy on the 12th.
Yeah,
if not then, there's a chance I might be able to join them or hook up with them somewhere else. I'd love to go out to Tahoe because I grew up in Northern California, Sacramento, San Francisco, and Tahoe is amongst my very favorite stomping grounds and have many fond memories of going there, you know, during the summer. And I'm not a skier, so it was always for summer recreation, so to speak. And Carl and I went up there a couple of times, met. He was actually, before his marriage to Annie, he was dating a young lady in Sacramento, and I went up there with them briefly. And that was probably early 64, I would guess, probably about the summer of 64. So love Tahoe. Hope I can join them at the, I don't know where they're going to be. I think they're going to be at the Sahara Tahoe or one of those casino ballroom type places, so that'll be a lot of fun. I corresponded with Billy Hinchey over the weekend, and of course California Saga is doing one of their rare opening dates in Tahoe. That'd be an extra added attraction for me because I could say hi to Billy and some of the, you know, the others. I mean, I go back so far. I think I'm the oldest guy that has been involved with the Beach Boys that is fortunately still vertical and not horizontal. So
well,
I used to, you know, bounce Wendy and Carney on my knee, and you know, I never really got to know Mike's two kids. I have met Christian at a couple of concerts in the last few years. Have not met his daughter. Of course, know Adam and Matt very, very well, and you know, I know Carney's husband, Rob, not well, but do know him, have introduced the girls once when they played Nashville at the Wild Horse Saloon about three or so years ago.
Well, Nashville is where you have your studio, is that correct?
That's right. I've been here actually since 74. I've had the studio since 80. This is our 32nd anniversary this summer. We're the oldest truly independent studio in Nashville that's still under its original management. I co-founded the studio with two partners in 1980, and I purchased their interests in 2000. So there are a couple of studios, Quadraphonic and Woodland, that are actually older than us, but they've been under a number of managements and bankruptcies and closures by the health department and that, and somehow or another we've managed to survive since 1980. So we're very thankful at doing what I love to do. You know, I've never really been out of radio and records since I was 12 years old. I mean, Bill Anderson, my buddy who I produced, who's a member of the Country Music Hall of Fame and also a former radio DJ, you know, he once said, if you can find something you love to do so much, you'd be willing to do it for free, then you'll never work a day in your life. And that's kind of the way I look at it. Sometimes it appears to be work, but in reality, I love what I do, and I love coming into the studio every morning, manage to keep it afloat. It's not as good of a return financially as it was in the 80s, because in the 80s, we didn't have as many studios. We didn't have as many labels. We also, you know, had no home studios, which have cut into our overdub business by 60-70% or more.
Wow.
And of course, there was no internet downloading, illegal file sharing that's cut into record revenue. So, you know, it's not quite the dollar that we were doing 20 so years ago. And of course, expenses have gone up. So it's almost a double whammy. We're taking in less revenue and we're spending more on supplies and electricity and payroll and advertising and insurance and maintenance and all that than we were back then. So it kind of hits you over the head twice, but I still love doing it. Love coming in. You know, I tell people, and I speak a lot to classes and organizations, National Association of Campus Activities and NARM and NARAs and schools and all that sort of stuff. And I tell them this, and it's very true. I said, I literally come to work. What gives me the enthusiasm to come to work is hopefully that, you know, one day another Brian Wilson or another Elton John or another, you know, great entertainer like an Elvis walks in our studio doors and we can be a part of their story. So that's what I live for. And, you know, it's fun being able to do this over the years and having been in so many segments of our industry, having seen it from so many different perspectives starting out as a kid. And, you know, David Leaf in his Beach Boys and the California Myth described me as the teenager with the DJ voice. And he actually missed it by a year. I got into radio when I was 12 and became a teen announcer on the radio and became a DJ at 15 and a program director and DJ at 17. And then in 18, I started dabbling in concert promotion and booking acts into school assemblies and teen clubs and all-night grad parties. And then the following year, 1963, of course, the big day in my life, May 24th, when I presented the Beach Boys live in concert for what actually became one of their very first, if not the very first, headlining appearance by them at a major auditorium venue, 5,300 seat Sacramento Memorial Auditorium. And I still have vivid remembrances of that day and picking them up at the airport in my folks' 1954 Chevy station wagon and loading all the gear in. And of course, there were no like the big airports. Sacramento was a big town. It was capital of California, and it was a big airport. But it was not like the one that they have now, which moved north and west of town. And, of course, in those days, you know, they rolled the stairs up to the plane's door, and you walked down the stairs, and you crossed the tarmac, and you picked up your luggage at the drive-up area where you could unload and load your car. Of course, no security. And there were also no roadies, so we all grabbed equipment, you know, a couple of amps and Denny's drums and guitars and Mike Sacks, and we loaded it into my folks' car and drove down to the auditorium. So that was quite a bit different from, you know, now, which I understand each of the guys has a bus, from what I understand anyway. You know, I'm sure there's a couple of 18-wheelers involved and a crew for sure, guitar techs and roadies and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's a little bit different nowadays from what it was in May of 1963, that's for sure.
Fred, let me ask you this. We're talking about the 50th anniversary before we go back to Sacramento and that first concert album. But did it surprise you at all that the band has reunited, I might even say restored relationships? It seems like it's much more than we're doing this for the money and we'll act polite on stage.
Well, when I saw the interview that it was Mike, and I can't remember, people send me links all the time, or I go to YouTube, and sometimes I don't even know what I'm looking at. But I noticed when he spoke, you know, he actually seemed pretty down to earth. I was kind of amazed because I knew the anniversary was coming. Technically, it could have been last year, 2011, because they actually did their first gig in Long Beach on December 31st, and that Richie Valens Memorial Concert. And so it actually could have been last year, but, you know, they made it this year was a wise choice because I think it gave Mike and Brian a chance to, you know, get a little bit closer and have some conversations. And I'm sure there were other people involved. You know, I really did not know that they'd be able to put this together. I'm glad they did, but I'm even more glad that Brian's back on his feet and has actually been touring pretty regularly since 1998, and every time I would go to see him, whether it was Philadelphia, Upper Darby, where he played the Tower Theater, and he politely invited me to introduce him. That was that first tour in '98, and then I saw him in St. Louis for the I think I saw him for the Smile album there, if I'm not mistaken. And then the Pet Sounds in Detroit, that was interesting. Michigan Hills at the shed or the outside venue there that we used to play every summer near York, Michigan Hills, that area. And then I saw him when he was opening, or you can't say opening, but he was co-headlining with, you know, with Paul Simon, and I saw him in Indy there. You know, and every time that I've seen him, he seemed to get stronger and had more confidence and you know, and really seemed to be enjoying it more. You know, the last time I saw him was, Ryman, was 2008, and he and Jeffrey asked me to introduce him, and I was honored to do so because that's such a historic venue. But as far as, you know, the whole thing coming together and putting aside the, burying the hatchet, you know, putting aside the personal issues, it's just great to see them all together. But it's been great since 98 to see Brian, you know, back on stage and performing. I mean, there were people that thought that would never happen, you know, and every time I go to see him, I'm just thankful that he's still here. And I was, it kind of brought me back to reality about 2 weeks ago, Robin Gibb passed away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, Morris had died a few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I said, how ironic that of the two great brother groups, the Bee Gees and the Beach Boys, the last ones standing are the two older brothers.
Mm.
You know, to me, that's just amazing, you know. So, yeah, I'm glad to see them. As I mentioned earlier, I have not seen the concert. I've seen clips of it on YouTube, like everybody, and a bunch of fans who have seen it have sent me set lists, and they've sent me their reviews, and all the reactions that I've seen, even the professional reviews in media, have been overwhelmingly positive. And I'm really glad. I wrote Jeffrey an email over the weekend. They were playing Bonnaroo, which is only about 60 miles or so from where I'm sitting right now, but I didn't get to see him. I didn't get a hold of him in time, and they've only been arriving, you know, briefly before each show, I think 45 minutes, and hasn't been a big window of opportunity to visit, and I was unable to get a hold of, you know, the tour manager or any of the guys to set me up, and I didn't want to drive out there on a fluke because it's a long drive and a lot of traffic, and it was the last day of Bonnaroo, and I think they expected 80 to 100,000 people, and, you know, so I didn't see them this weekend. That was yesterday. You know, I think they were supposed to go on around 3 o'clock, and, you know, the next shot, like I said, is Cincinnati, which is tomorrow, and I may or may not drive up there for the day, possibly. So I do anticipate seeing the show. I'm just not quite sure when, but I've certainly had, you know, a lot of opportunities to read reviews and see YouTube clips. Of course, the audio always sucks. You know, it's not very good. But, you know, outdoor venues are not very good to begin with, so, you know, they're doing a number of those, and I'd love to see him in a, you know, in a small theater, you know, 2,500 seats, kind of like the Ryman. I think it's about 2,200. It's a great place to see them because it's, you know, it's a great acoustically designed room. And, you know, like they played the Beacon in New York, and they played a small theater down in Tampa, and I know they've done several. So that would be kind of cool. But
that was my experience in Chicago, a Chicago theater. I'm not sure how many thousands, but it's not huge. And it was that. They just paid great attention to detail. It sounded as good as can be in a live setting. And they all seem to be having a good time, not just singing, but together.
Read, and that's what I kind of see on stage. I would have loved to have been at the Bowl a week ago seen Cal Saga and, you know, the second generation, so to speak, and along with the boys. That would have been great. And that's why I'd like to see him at Tahoe, if possible. And I think it's sometime in July. I think it's the 15th, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I sure hope they get to have you there. That'd be great. Take us back again a little bit to those early Sacramento days. You were talking about them piling into your station wagon. But do you have recollection, memories of when you just thought of the idea, why don't we invite the Beach Boys here to a big concert? I mean, back then, certainly it was a very different time, but still, that was a huge step for anybody, let alone someone in his teen years, a peer, really, to them. Do you remember what boiled up to get you to do this?
Oh, I remember fluently. You know, I mean, we could spend a, you know, quite a bit of time just talking about the lead up. But basically, to make a long story short, I'd been active in radio starting when I was, you know, 12 years old. I wrote for the student newspaper at El Camino High School, which was in the north area of Sacramento. There were a number of student body offices, as all schools have, and, you know, president, girls vice president, boys vice president, and secretary and treasurer. And then we had three commissioners, Commissioner of Public Relations, Commissioner of Internal Affairs, and Commissioner of Entertainment. And the Commissioner of Entertainment was in charge of the assemblies and the rallies and et cetera. And I had run for Commissioner of Public Relations, had lost, had run for Commissioner of Entertainment in when I was a junior, had lost. And so this was the second half of our senior year. It was my last hurrah. It was my last opportunity to run in the, you know, for the spring student body executive board. And there were, the incumbent was running again, and there were six other girl students that were running. One of them was a real popular gal, Tylee Jones. You might call her the big gal on campus, so to speak. She was very, very popular, had a lot of friends, and I really didn't know between her and the incumbent if I had a shot. But back in those days, the students' assemblies were pretty much, you know, homegrown talent. We had, you know, I had a gymnast that was quite good, and we had a couple of bands. And I tell people that, ironically, they weren't surf bands or rock and roll bands. We actually had a guy named John DeVinny, who had a big band with, you know, horns and, you know, keyboards and the whole enchilada, and he was quite popular, so he had bands. It was during the era of the the Kingston Trio and the Chad Mitchell Trio and all the folk acts, so, you know, we had folk groups, you know, folk trios and stuff. And so my goal, my campaign promise was to, if I were elected Commissioner of Entertainment, I'd bring big name entertainment stars to the school assemblies, and that was my platform. And, you know, they voted, and actually what happened was there was a runoff. The incumbent got defeated, and then it was just me and Tylee, and we were up against each other, and that was it. That would determine who won the election. And I didn't really think I had a shot, quite honestly. I mean, I knew I had a lot of followers, but going up this against this very popular gal, you know, I just wasn't sure. And one of her best friends, Nikki Vanderhyde, who was a song leader, you know, very popular on campus also, and she and I had six period drama together, and she was able to get a hall pass to go down to where they were counting the runoff votes in the office, in the front office. And, you know, this was maybe 20 minutes before the end of the school day, and she came back down to the room, and she came into the drama class, and she was crying, and she kind of looked at me, and I knew I'd won. I mean, it was one of those things you just don't forget, you know. So my goal had been fulfilled, and now I had to come up with the campaign promise. And fortunately, Sacramento had two hotels that each had ballrooms, and they brought in artists. And so I went to the two heads of the hotel, the general managers, and one of them was the owner, and I told them that I, you know, went to El Camino, which was in an affluent area of Sacramento. It was growing. It was the north area. It was expanding. And it was the new money, so to speak. The old money was in South Sacramento and Southland Park. And, you know, this was kind of the new expanding area of Sacramento. And so I said, well, if you'd let me bring out these entertainers from time to time, I'm sure if the kids like them, they'll talk their parents into coming down and, you know, paying for a show, going to one of your dinner shows or one of your late night shows or whatever. And, they were in agreement. So I brought in Rusty Draper, who had been a big act in the 50s, you know, 40s and 50s, actually. As a matter of fact, one of Rusty's big hits was That Lucky Old Sun, which later became a title of a Brian Wilson album.
Wow.
That was one of his hits, and he had a few others. And then the Diamonds, who had The Stroll and One Summer Night and Little Darlin', which was a huge hit. And they were, I brought them out, and brought out a couple of other acts that weren't as big names and that never did really make it to the big time. And finally, in May, about a month, less than a month before school was to let out for the summer, There was going to be a big surf show at the county fairgrounds, or at the county fair, which was held at the California State Fairgrounds, and it was called the Twist something or other. I can't remember the complete title, but I called the promoter who was not local, was in San Francisco, and convinced him to let me bring the entire cast of this concert out to the high school. And so I met him at the Sacramento Inn where they were staying, and they followed me out to the high school. And by the time we got out there, because one of the members of the entourage, one of the duet members, had missed his flight, and we had to wait for him. And, so we all went out there. By the time we got out there, school was out. It was supposed to have been like around 2:30, and by the time we got out there, it was 3 o'clock, and school was out. And it had gotten out on the radio that some kid was bringing all these acts out to the El Camino High School boys' gym for this free concert. So kids from all over the district were coming, and the fire marshal was there, and the Sacramento County Sheriff was there, and they'd closed the doors. They wouldn't allow anybody more in, and the vice principal was just mad at me. I mean, he just, how can you keep us waiting? Don't you know school's out? And, you know, but anyway, the show must go on. So I introduced them, and that show was my huge send off. It consisted of Bobby Freeman, who wrote and recorded the first version of Do You Want to Dance, and later done by the Beach Boys and by the Mamas and the Papas, Bertha Tillman, Johnny Crawford, TV star of the Rifleman, the iconic TV series of the 50s, who was a hit recording artist then, had a couple of top five records. Jan and Dean, and that was Jan had missed the flight, so he was on the show. And as you would have it, the Smokey Robinson and the Original Miracles with his wife Claudette and his cousin Bobby. And I mean, it was a huge, huge show. And you know, little did any of us know that the Miracles would become giants, and Smokey would become giants. They'd be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And of course, Jan and Dean, a year later, would be back on the scene with Surf Music and Surf City and their connection with the Beach Boys and all that. So it was a pretty big show. So that's kind of what the senior year, that was my triumph, so to speak. I often didn't think of, well, what if I would have been a junior and I would have been coming back as a senior the following year, I probably could have run for student body president and won in a landslide. But it was fun putting it on. It was great, to meet all those people and work with all those people in such an early time. And then I booked the high school grad party. We all had grad parties in those days. After you graduated, usually in the evening, then you'd go home and you'd get out of your fancy clothes and you'd dress more casual, and you'd go to a country club or you'd go to a restaurant, and they'd have a private grad party that, usually started around 9 o'clock and went till 6 o'clock in the morning. And they would have movies, and they'd have dance band, and they'd have buffets, and they'd have door prizes and all this sort of stuff. So they asked me to book the grad party, so I brought in Jerry Wallace and Bobby Freeman, who had appeared at that concert, and it was a huge success. So that was 62, and that was at my grad party. So a year later, it looked quite a little bit less than a year later, about March, I was going to school at Sacramento State College, which is now California State University, Sacramento. And I was, actually I was a pre-med student when I first went in, and then I decided my heart really wasn't in medicine, and I changed it to journalism major and a broadcasting minor. And I was on the campus station, and I was the freshman representative on the activities council, and I was chairman of the concert committee, and was doing the same thing at Sacramento State as I'd been doing at El Camino. So I brought in a force freshman, believe it or not, Brian's group that kind of sent him in the harmony direction, and I brought in a piano player that was on PBS named Max Morath, and he was quite popular, and brought him in. And the high school senior class who had been juniors when I was going to El Camino came to me and said, well, our all-night grad party's coming up, and we'd love you to book the talent for the grad party like you did at yours last year, which was such a success. And I said, great, I'd love to do it. You know, I was working at an FM radio station for probably about a buck and a half, buck 75, maybe $2 an hour. And I was studying while I was on the console at night. I worked at a station, KJML FM, which was out in the north area, and it was a good music station. And every night at 8 o'clock, we'd play a Broadway show, basically uninterrupted. We'd play, it was all vinyl, of course, so we'd play, you know, like if it was Sound of Music or Oklahoma or whatever, you'd play the A side of the record, which was maybe 15, 18 minutes long, and then you'd do a commercial or two, and then you'd flip it over and you'd play the B side. And it was during that half hour, 40-minute period that I would study for my exams and study, you know, for stuff at the college. And I was having fun, you know, doing what I was doing, but I wasn't making a lot of money. So to me, to be able to book their grad party, I could probably make, you know, $50 or so as a marketing fee. So that would be, you know, good money for me, you know, for a kid who's 18, 19 years old. So, you know, I said, I'd love to do it, and how much do you have? You know, they told me they had $750, and I said, great, we can get a band, we can get maybe a single or maybe a band and a duet, and should have a pretty decent budget. We ought to have a great party. And they said, oh, Fred, I'm sorry, we didn't want to mislead you. No, we have $750 for the entire grad party. And I said, you mean the venue, the catering, invitations, door prizes, the movie, the whole thing? And they said, yeah. And I said, you can't do it. I did not enough money. Well, they'd been, you know, making this money at, you know, car washes and newspaper drives and candy sales. You know, the same way kids make money now, we were doing 50 years ago. You know, and, you know, it's kind of ironic that the more things change, the more things remain the same, because this summer in September, I go to my 50th high school reunion in Sacramento on the 22nd of September, and, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I have been for a year or two. But I told them they didn't have enough money to get entertainment, let alone, I mean, it'd be tight to put on the grad party, let alone have entertainment. And it just kind of just devastated them, you know, it just kind of busted their bubble. And they were really disappointed. And they said, well, what can we do? And I said, well, I got a great idea. I said, why don't we find a group or an act and we'll put on a concert and we'll sell tickets at school and, you know, we'll sell tickets at local record shops and that sort of thing. And we'll raise the money, you know, we'll gamble, we'll put it all on the line. And of course the kids loved the idea, but the
sure.
parents, the advisors and the school principal thought that the kids were crazy to give all the money that they'd earned in during that year with the car washes and such, to give it all to this kid, Fred Vail, who was barely a year older than they were, and, you know, let me gamble with this money. And the kids finally just basically held their ground, and they basically told the principal and the dad advisors or the parent committee or whatever. They said, well, we earned the money, and we believe in Fred, and we're willing to, you know, to do it, and you should let us do it. And they got, I guess the advisors and all that got so fed up that they basically just said, okay, have it your way, but if Fred loses your money, you won't have a grad party because there's not enough time to, you know, to earn any more money. You just won't have to have a grad party. So they said, well, we believe in him, and look what he did the year before, and, you know, we're willing to do it. So they gave me the go-ahead to do the arrangements, and I had to find an act. And, you know, surf music was hot, but there were literally dozens of surf bands. I mean, the Ventures had really started it, and Dick Dale and the Deltones, who the Beach Boys had opened for, and the Shantays and the Astronauts and the Lively Ones and the Challengers and all these different surfing bands. But the one difference was that there was this group of kids from Hawthorne that not only, you know, played guitar and did great surf music, but they also did great harmonies, and they had some great original songs. They weren't just instrumental covers. And so I decided we should book the Beach Boys, and then I set out to find them. Well, you got to remember that this is March, maybe early April of 1963, so the majority of their songs had not been written, let alone recorded. The first record, Surfin' on Candex, had come out. I think it only made it into the low 60s on the national chart. I don't think Surfin' Safari did much better. They only had the one album out, and they had just released Surfin' USA, and it was starting to get play, but it was by no means at that point a hit. And I called all around to try to find them, and I kept getting sent from lead to lead. And I remember running into this guy named Harvey Kluschmeyer. He was quite a character, and he said, "Oh, I represent the Beach Boys." And I said, "Well, I need them for a Friday or a Saturday in May." And he said, "Well, it'll be $800, you know." And I said, "Well, I don't have $800. I'll have to get back to you." And so I started making more calls, and I finally talked to somebody at Capitol, and they told me that they thought that the Beach Boys had just signed with the William Morris Agency, which is one of the great, you know, historic talent agencies in the country. Still around, by the way, and they go back to the 1800s. So I called the William Morris Agency, and the gal answered the phone, like the receptionist, and I said, "This is Fred Vail calling long distance from Sacramento. I'm trying to book the Beach Boys." And she said, "Who?" And I said, "The Beach Boys." And she said, "Oh, I'm not aware of that group." And I said, "Well, your record label told me that they've just signed with your agency. Can you connect me with your variety department," which back in those days booked all the one-nighters and stuff. And so she sent me to the variety department, and the secretary answered the phone, and I said, "I'm Fred Vail. I'm calling from Sacramento. Capitol Records told me you just signed the Beach Boys." And she said, "Yes, we did." And I said, "Well, I'd like to book them." And she said, "Well, I'll put you through to their junior agent, Marshall Burrell." And found out that Marshall was the nephew of Melton Burrell, who, of course, was a huge television star and icon. And that shows you that nepotism still flies. It's who you know, not what you know all the time. And so I ended up talking to him about booking the boys. And we had a little bit of conversation. He took down some information. You know, I asked him how much it would be. And he said they were $500. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I've already saved $300. I'm on my way, you know. And so I said, "Well, check the dates. And I'd like them on May 24th if possible. It's a weekend night." And he said, "Well, I'll get back to you." And he hung up, and I expected to hear from him, you know, within an hour or two. Actually, as it turned out, I think it was the next day he reached me, and said, "Well, I have good news and I have bad news," kind of. I don't think he actually said that, but he meant that. I said, "Well, what is it?" And he says, "Well, you can have them on the 24th, but unfortunately, they're living at home. They only do a lot of Southern California gigs that they can drive to. Obviously, they can't drive 450 miles to Sacramento. They're going to have to fly." So I talked with their manager, their dad, Murray, and he said that they could either do it for $750 or $500 plus me, Fred, I would have to pay for 6 round-trip airline tickets. And back in those days, Western Airlines and Pacific Southwest Airlines, PSA, it was about $60-$70 a ticket round-trip from L.A. to Sacramento. So I did the math in my head and said, "Well, I'll take the $750 flat." So I saved another $50 or $75, yeah, and booked the Beach Boys. And it was, 1963, so they actually issued the contracts to one of the fathers, one of the parents on the advisory council, because I was not of legal age. Back then, legal age was 21. It was not 18, and I was 19. So got the contracts. And then, we'd secured the Beach Boys, and now it was just a matter of starting to promote the show. So if you had any questions up to this point, you can ask them, or then I'll go into part two, which is the show itself and how that all came about.
We definitely want to hear that. Before you do, I've just tried to be quiet because the story is an amazing backstory to the story of how this great experience and concert album got started. But one thing you mentioned is, as you were talking about all the different surf groups, I think each one of them was, almost purely, if not 100% instrumental. And, you said that the Beach Boys, of course, we know, played some instrumental tunes. At that stage, before they, became well-known as a vocal group, were they considered on a par with those other instrumental groups. We'd probably call them garage band type groups today.
Well, it's funny, Phil, that you should mention those two words, garage band. Do you happen to get Forgotten Hits?
Yes.
Kent Cotell out of Chicago.
Yep, he's here.
You know, well, I nominated the Beach Boys as America's first true garage band because they literally practiced in the converted garage of the home in Hawthorne, which Murray and Audrey had converted into a little music room and den. And so they were truly a garage band. And they didn't make the top 20 for the finalists. And he told me later, this was only about a month ago, he told me you were the only one that nominated him as a garage band. So I thought that was kind of humorous because they literally started in a garage. But anyway, you know, there were other guys were instrumental bands. I mean, Miserloo, of course, influenced
sure.
Carl, and they would play it at early concerts and stuff. And I just I booked Dick Dale. About a year after the Beach Boys, ironically, at the Governor's Hall in Sacramento, which was at the old California State Fairgrounds, and he was nominated and inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame here in Nashville about 4 years ago, roughly. And Al and Mary Ann came in. Al inducted him into the Musicians Hall of Fame. And I had a poster of that concert, and I brought it down. And,
oh, my.
And I had him sign it, you know, for so that brought back memories to him and, you know, and to me, and had a chance to, you know, chat with Al and Mary Ann for a while at the reception afterwards. And, you know, so it was a really cool evening. But, yeah, I mean, they did vocals, and these other acts were primarily, you know, instrumental surfing bands. And in the very, very early on, probably – oh, by July, maybe, of 63, August, somewhere in that area, I was billing them as America's number one surfing band. That's on the posters. You might be able to find them on some sites, and it says America's number one surfing band. And then by December, you know, I went to Murray and I said, you know, this music has gone way beyond surfing, Murray. We need to change it. And he says, well, what should we change it to? And I said, how about America's number one vocal instrumental group? So we used that for a while, including the live concert poster. But no, they were surfing band, you know. But they did vocals, and you know, it was one of those things where I knew that they were going to have some hits. I mean, I just knew. I mean, I was kind of following the activity on Surfing USA, and as fate would have it, and I was just lucky. I've been really blessed with some good timing and some luck. But ironically, the week before they appeared in Sacramento on that May 24th concert, Surfin' USA had peaked at number one on KXOA and Croy Radio, which were the two top 40 stations in Sacramento. So the timing couldn't have been better. It was just a blessing. We were ahead of the crowd because we were a West Coast station, and, you know, we got on records earlier, and the Beach Boys had a following on the West Coast, you know, San Diego and San Bernardino and L.A. and, you know, up the coast of Portland and Seattle and San Francisco, Sacramento. So a lot of the stations on the West Coast were early to get on Beach Boy Records. And of course, at Surfin' USA did ultimately become their first top 10 record. So, and then the album came out. So that was going for me. I used a lot of my radio contacts. Every radio station in Sacramento knew me, either because I'd worked as a gopher or I'd been on the air. So they all knew me, and I went to them, and I said, I'm doing this concert at the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium, and it's being sponsored by the El Camino High School senior class, and it's a fundraiser for their all-night grad party, and I said, they're a public service, and I said that we'd appreciate it if you guys would run some PSAs, some public service announcements, and they all agreed to do it. So I had free radio time, didn't cost us anything. I printed up some posters to put in record shop windows and musical instrument store windows and out at the high school, and I think I got them for about $60. And one of those posters is probably now worth $5,000 to $6,000, and I think I bought them all for about $60. Printed tickets, had a music store downtown called Coast Radio that, you know, put the tickets on sale, did it for free. There was no Ticketmaster. you know, kids weren't getting ripped off by that organization yet. That was a number of years down the road. So it was $1.75, and the record store and the musical instrument stores did it for free. I mean, I put them on the poster, I put them on the radio spot, so they got free advertising. It drove kids into the store to buy the tickets, so they were more than willing to do it for free. So I had Southgate Records in the south part of Sacramento, I had Coast Radio downtown, and then I had Jack's House of Music, which was a musical instrument store out in the north area of Sacramento, and then we sold them at the high school, and then we sold them at what they call this old Civic Theater box office, which was a box office that carried all the tickets of all the different events, whether it was the music circus or it was the Harlem Globetrotters coming to the auditorium or the Shrine Circus or whatever. They carried all these tickets, and I think they were the only ones that charged me a small box office fee, like a small commission. It wasn't very much. I don't remember it being a big deal at all. It might have been, you know, 10 cents or something like that. But that was it. So we had the free advertising on radio. We had all the stores, you know, selling the tickets for free. And then I put all the other expenses. I bought the auditorium. You got to think, this is, you know, May of 1963, and it's amazing now. But I booked the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium, which held 5,300 plus kids or people. And I booked it for $150 plus 5% of the gross over 1,500. So basically, the auditorium gave the promoter $1,500 to meet their nut, you know, and then they took 5% over $1,500, and along with the $150 guarantee. I got two off-duty policemen, Tiny Hansen and Lynn Chatoyan, were the two cops that became regulars at all the Beach Boy concerts, became friends of the Beach Boys. I got them for, I think, $25 a piece for security. I got a ticket taker, ticket seller, for about $40 for the seller and $20 for the taker. And then I think I had a spotlight guy for about $75. And then I had a sound guy for $100.50 that included the PA system and the operator to operate the PA system, which back then, if I recall, consisted of three microphones.
Oh my.
So that was, the overhead was total was under $1,500. Tickets were $1.75. So that afternoon, I went out, and before I went out to the airport, I think they got in around 6. Before I went out to the airport, I went by the ticket locations to pick up the money and what we call the deadwood, which were the unsold tickets. And then I drove out to the airport and then picked the guys up and put all the gear into the back of my folks' wagon and started driving downtown. And, you know, we had another car. I think Murray either rented one or my friend Mike Davidson drove one, but we had another car and split the group up, and then we had all the gear in the back of the wagon. And we're driving down to the gig, and Carl's, you know, sitting in the front seat, and he says, well, who are we opening for? And I said, well, you're the headliners. There is no opening act. And he kind of said something to the effect, well, we haven't done that. He said, I hope the promoter doesn't lose any money. And I said, Carl, I said, I'm Fred Vail. I'm the promoter. And he looked over at me and he said, well, you're just a kid like we are. And I said, yeah, but I'm the guy that hired you. And I think we'll do all right. I said, I went by and I picked up the advance sale, and we'll break even at least. I mean, we have enough in the box office receipts at this point to pay for you guys and to pay for, you know, all the other miscellaneous expenses. I said, it's just going to be a matter of how many people, you know, we draw that's going to show how much money we make. You know, we've already made back our $1,500. And, you know, so went and set up and then went over to the hotel. They were staying at the Mansion Inn, which is only a few blocks from the auditorium, right across from the old governor's mansion in Sacramento. And on 16th and H, I think. And we, you know, they changed, and we went back over to the auditorium and went in, and I introduced them, and curtain went up, and, you know, and actually, the first show, believe it or not, Brian did not show up at. And I've never found out the absolute reason why. I mean, it was funny because there were rumors floating around why he wasn't there, and one that he'd raped a girl. Well, that's not too good, you know. But, you know, he wasn't there, so Al actually was back with the group playing bass and singing Brian's part, and Dave Marks was in the group, you know, then. So it was Carl and Alan and Mike and Dennis and Dave. Dave, Carl, Mike, Al, Dennis. There we go. They were the five Beach Boys. So they went on and they did the first set. They were gonna do, so we decided to do two short sets because, you know, they were used to opening. They didn't do two-hour, three-hour concerts, whatever, and they didn't have that many hits anyway. So they went in and did the first set, and they did, of course, Surfing, Surfing Safari, Surfing USA. And then they did, like, Farmer's Daughter, and they did, I think they did Surfer Girl. I remember they did covers like Denny did The Wanderer or Run Around Sue, one of the Dion DiMucci songs. Al did Del Shannon's Runaway, did a few other covers, like Miserloo, the Dick Dale record, and I think I mentioned Farmer's Daughter they did. So it was, you know, the show ended, or the set ended, and the curtain went down, the kids were screaming, and the Beach Boys were just so excited that they'd gone over, and it was a decent concert, and, you know, Murray was telling them what they needed to do, and, you know, smile more, and Carl, treble up, you know, you need to treble up on your guitar, and they were basically critiquing themselves, and all of a sudden it dawned on them, one of them, said, oh my God, we still got another set, you know, we've already shot our wad, so to speak, and they said, what are we going to do? And I said, well, why don't you do this, do some of those songs that went over well in the first set, just do them again, Denny do longer drum solos, Carl do longer guitar solos. If you have any new songs you want to try out, go ahead and try them because nobody's heard them. We don't know what they sound like anyway. So go ahead and do that. So they went back out, and the second set came off without a hitch, and kids screamed and cheered, and the curtains went down. And, you know, we all were just everybody slapping around the back and, you know, high five, so to speak. And they were so elated that they'd gone over so well. And so we went back to the auditorium, or from the auditorium back to the hotel. And it was still early. Cause, I mean, we only did like, you know, we started at 8, and I think we were out of there by 9:30, 9:45. The hotel was only a few blocks away. So we went back to the hotel and went in the dining room and sat down at this table to have something to eat. And, you know, typical burgers and fries and milkshakes and Cokes and stuff, and all talking about how well it had gone over. All the guys were there, even Mike. And he hadn't split, and, you know, and sometimes he'd kind of head out and do whatever Mike does in those days. But we, you know, we were all having a good talk, and they were all thrilled that it had come off, and they'd glad we made money, and, you know, they were thrilled that, you know, they'd had a good show, and everybody accepted them, and all that. And finally, I remember Carl was over there, the other side of the table, and I was next to Murray, and he was, like, kind of diagonal with me at this, you know, this table, and he said, hey, Pop, how much did we make tonight? And he, you know, pulls out an envelope out of his pocket, and he's saying, well, William Morris, you know, Mr. Vail paid us $750, and we had to take our round-trip airline tickets out of that, and we had to pay the William Morris commission out of that, and we got to rent a car, and we got a couple of hotel rooms, because all the guys back then used to double and triple up. You know, there were no suites, there were no solo rooms, single rooms, no limos, you know, none of that stuff. So, you know, they'd had a couple of rooms to take out, and the meal, and he said, well, I think, you know, in ballpark numbers, we, you know, each of you guys made between $50 and $60 tonight. And they were ecstatic, you know, because that was good money. I mean, I remind kids when I speak at schools, you know, not only were the concert tickets $1.75, and now it's $100, $200, $300 to go to some of these shows, but not only was, you know, the tickets cheap, but, you know, you could go out on a date. You could put $1 gas in the car, which was, you know, 3, 4, 5 gallons, roughly, $1. You know, you could go to Mel's Drive-In or McDonald's, or we had a local McDonald's called Harvey's, and you go there and you could, you know, get burgers, fries, and a Coke or a milkshake for the two of you, and, you know, each of you, and then you could go to a movie and you'd spend $10 or less. You could probably do it for like $6, $7. The whole night, you know, the whole, you know, gas, food, concert, or theater ticket for two people for $5 to $10. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it, Phil?
It sure does.
So anyway, so for they were going to make $50 to $60, that was good money for a teenager. And you got to remember, you know, I think David was 14, Carl was 16, Denny was 18, Mike was, I think, 22, and Brian and Al were 20. I think that's what the ages were. And I was 19. I was just a few months older than Dennis. He was, you know, he turned 19 in December, and I had turned 19 in March, and this was now May. So that was the, you know, we. Oh, then they looked at me and they said, "Well, how do you do, Mr. Vail?" And I looked at him and I said, "Me and the class made $4,000, $4,000." And like, they couldn't believe it. Their jaws dropped and they slurped their cokes and they said, "You made $4,000?" And I said, "Yes." And but let me remind you, you know, it was the only time I ever made more money than the Beach Boys, which is the next chapter of the story. But, you know, we made $4,000, and they made basically, you know, $300 between them. And, you know, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. But, you know, that Murray, of course, he's a businessman. He had Able Machinery Company, and
right.
He's, you know, full-time dad and part-time manager, and the three boys are still living at home, and Audrey's a stay-at-home mom, and, you know, just like my family, my dad was the breadwinner, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and, you know, she raised the family and put the meals on the table just like Audrey did. And, you know, Murray was running Able Machinery, which was selling lathes and drill presses and heavy-duty, you know, manufacturing equipment. And that was his day gig. So he said, "Well, you know, you did a great job, Mr. Vail." He's always called me Mr. Vail. You know, he was like my dad, you know. I mean, he's about the same age, gone through the Depression and gone through World War II. And, you know, he's very polite, and there's two defenders of Murray Wilson, and I'm proud to be one of the two. The other was Rick Han of the Sunrays, and he and I, you know, knew Murray. We knew the good side of Murray. We didn't know the mythical side of Murray and the stories, that some of which were exaggerated over the years. But, you know, Murray was a great guy. He was, you know, he was a shrewd guy. I mean, I give him credit where credit is due. Maybe 7 years ago, 8 years ago now, I went out to California on business. I think it was 06. So it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, it was 06. Went out to California on business, and while I was out there, I called my old friend from Capitol Records, Ken Nelson, who was the head of A&R for Capitol in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, and he was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame when he turned 92, and I was at his induction and honored to have known the gentleman. And, you know, he signed people like Buck Owens and Glenn Campbell and Sonny James and Merle Haggard to Capitol Records and produced most of those artists. And he told me the story about Murray and the Beach Boys and Capitol. Murray, after they lost the contract at Candex, which had really gone under, it had financial issues, and it you know, they only put out the one single, Surfing. And all of a sudden, the Beach Boys didn't have a record label, and they wanted to follow up, and Murray knew Ken Nelson. And Ken told me, I went out to Ventura where Ken was living, and he was alive, and he was living in Ventura at the time, and we ended up having a whole afternoon to talk, and took me to dinner, and my friend George Van Wynn to dinner, who was out living in California. And he told me that Murray started calling him, and he said his sons and a nephew and a friend were in a band. They were doing surf music. They had a single out. It penetrated the top 50, or top 100, didn't make it to the 50s, and they needed a record deal. And Ken basically reminded Murray that, "Hey, I'm the VP of A&R, but I'm the country guy. I'm not the pop guy," and they have their own department. And Murray said, "Well, if I drop off some demos and a copy of the single, you get it to the right person." And Kenny said, "Sure." So, you know, Murray left it off at the desk at Capitol at the Tower, and, you know, Ken got it and brought it to Nick Vinay, who was the pop A&R guy there. And, And Murray called back about, you know, a couple of days later. Well, you know, has Nick gotten back to you? What does he think of my boys? And Ken said, well, I haven't heard from him. And he said, well, can you follow through again? And so Ken called Nick, and Nick promised to listen to it again. And a week later, hadn't heard anything. You know, Murray's calling Ken, and, you know, has Vinay heard it yet? No, he hasn't, and I'll get back to you. And Ken called down. This happened for a couple of weeks, and Ken was tired of covering for Vinay, and he finally got him, and he said, listen, you got to listen to this Beach Boy record. He said, their father, Murray, is hounding me. Please listen, you know. And sure enough, Nick listened and signed the group. You know, I mean, had it not been for Murray's persistence, who knows where they would have ended up, you know. I mean, it was just, I mean, he was that kind of a guy. He was determined to promote the group, and he believed in the group. And, you know, three of them were his sons, and, you know, one was a nephew, and, you know, he loved music, and, you know, he wanted all the best for them, and he was proud of them. And, you know, and it's, you know, maybe without a Murray Wilson at the time, you know, maybe they were just an act signed to another manager that had, you know, no vested interest, so to speak. It's possible that they might have not had the, you know, the push and the luck of getting signed to a major label at the time. I mean, you can't really second guess these things, Phil. I mean, all things are predetermined by someone bigger than all of us. I mean, this is you know, this is it. I mean, a lot of things have to do, obviously, with access and who you know, and a lot of it has to do with politics and favors, and a lot of it has to do with timing, a lot of it has to do with luck. But they ended up being at the right label at the right time, you know, and Capitol was that label. And, you know, I think that a lot of times some of these things get shuffled underneath the rug, you know, because Murray is made out to be this villainous guy, and in reality he's one of the reasons for their success, and he really is. I mean, I think that there are three things that I think really were the reasons that they were successful. I mean, and there were also the same three reasons that they didn't, you know, or couldn't, maybe wouldn't have become as successful as they were. But there are three things that I would change, basically, that are the three things that I think would have put them on a whole different path. One is they should have kept Murray at least another year, maybe a year and a half, through the Beatle invasion, the Europe, you know, the English invasion, because here you have the two biggest groups in the world on the same record label, Capitol, and the same record label in Europe, EK, you know, EMI. So, you know, it would have been nice to have Murray to push them a little bit more, maybe another year, year and a half. I'm not saying that ultimately they shouldn't have left each other, but I think it was a little bit premature. That's one reason. Number two, they should have played the Pop Festival in Monterey, Big Sur. They never should have dropped off of that bill. Brian was on the board of directors with McCartney. I mean, it was a stupid move. I don't care about the reasons for it, but they should have played Big Sur. I mean, that was where the music really shifted from, you know, the image that they had as, you know, more of a corporate band or an establishment band, for whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know, Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Big Brother, and all that stuff were basically launched at Big Sur, and the Beach Boys could have been part of that. They could have appealed to that crowd. They would have been accepted by that, you know, record buying and radio base. I think that would have changed them dramatically. And then, of course, the other huge mistake, was leaving Capitol Records. Never should have left Capitol. Mo Austin and Warner Brothers were nice folks. I was very, very involved in that. I was the liaison between the Beach Boys and Warner Brothers when we were working on Sunflower and putting out the first single, Add Some Music. But the problem was that Warner Brothers had no vested interest in the Beach Boys. Capitol Records had their catalog. Labels sign artists for their catalog. The groups may come and go, but the catalog remains. If the Beach Boys had not left Capitol, had stayed with them, had worked out their differences, whether it was Brother Records, you know, as an independent distributed label or what have you, Capitol would have had a vested interest to continue to promote them and put them at the top of their agenda. Instead, they go to Warner Brothers Records, where they're literally the new kids on the block. They're still legendary by that time, but they're not as hot as some of the other groups that were that would become part of the Warner Brothers roster, you know, James Taylor and Morrison and, you know, Fleetwood Mac down the road, et cetera. But had they not left Capitol, I think they would have been in far better shape because they would have had that first album, Sunflower, promoted more heavily. They would have had the single, Add Some Music, promoted more heavily. The Beach Boys had friends at Capitol, including Carl Ingeman, the head of A&R. They had promotional people there. They loved the group, Al Corey. You know, I mean, it was one of those things where they never, never should have left Capitol Records. And now they're back there again, you know. So, you know, they lost a lot of groundwork in between, you know, because they were in Warners and that didn't work. And they were on Caribou CBS and that really never worked. And, you know, but had they just stayed with Capitol and saw it out, you know, I think it would have, you know, been totally different. So, you know, those are my three things. But Murray was a great guy. So Murray fought for them, and they got the Capitol deal, and they ended up, you know, being out and having a lot of hit records, and, you know, the concert appearances became their thing. I mean, Murray, I told Murray, I said, this is the first night now. This goes back to May 24th of 63. I said, there's going to be a lot of promoters like me that are going to make big money because I truly feel that William Morris does not know your potential. They don't know what they have. They're underselling you as a group. And there's going to be a lot of promoters that are going to make a lot of money because of William Morris not knowing exactly what we have here. And I said, you know, the future for this group, other than the writing those great songs, which, you know, you I'm sure you'll continue to do, but I said, your big money is going to be in concerts. That's where the big money is. Record royalties, if you manage to get paid, are nowhere near your, you know, your personal appearance revenue stream. That's, you know, just the way it is, and you're paid right away. You don't have to wait for 6 months, a year, 18 months to get a royalty check. You get paid when you perform. And, you know, I said, you guys, really, you're going to be a great concert act. You know, and I often think it's kind of funny when they announced the 50th reunion about a year ago, and I often think, what if I would have opened my mouth that night at that table at the Mansion Inn and said, you're so darn good, we're going to be singing your song 50 years from now. They'd look at me like I'd lost my frickin' screw. You know,
right.
This kid is two cards short of a full deck. But instead, you know, Murray said, well, you know, do you have any ideas? And that's when I came up with my first great idea. I said, yeah, I got an idea. I said, why don't you do what I did tonight? And Murray said, well, what do you mean? And I said, why don't you promote your own concerts? And Murray said, well, it's a great idea, Fred, but I've got a full-time job, and, you know, I can't go out on the road and set concerts up. And I said, well, I'll do it. And he looked at me, and the guys looked at me, and they said, would you? And I said, sure. And my only real mistake, you know, obviously I was one guy, one kid. I didn't know that night that I would drop out of school to join them and, you know, become their first concert promoter, first advance man per se. But, you know, I was only one person. You know, I wasn't a corporation. I wasn't an entity. And I could only set up, you know, one or two a month. That's all I could do, you know. You had to scout the area. You know, I told Murray, what you need to do is, number one, you need to concentrate on secondary markets. Don't worry about the Philadelphias and the New Yorks and the Miamis and the Atlantas and the LAs. William Morris will take care of that. But why don't we go into the secondary markets who rarely get entertainment? Go into the Renos, the Boises, the Spokanes, the Salt Lake Cities, the Jacksonville, Floridas, you know, the San Bernardinos. That's where we'll make money because those kids rarely get to see stars in their markets. And he said, well, I think you've got something there. So that's what we ended up, you know, concentrating on. But I could only do a few concerts at a time. You know, you had to go in and set them up. I'd advance them and set up ticket locations and check the halls out and, you know, book the rooms and the plane flights and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, had I been 10 people, I could have done a lot more, but I was only one guy, and, you know, and I was 19 years old. So, you know, it worked out well, and it was always something that I treasure, you know, doing all those shows, and something that I remember fondly and very fortunate to be able to remember. And people are amazed that I remember all these little details. But, you know, that was what I was doing. That was what I loved doing. I mean, that's the pride that I took in it. And, you know, to the Beach Boys, it was, you know, just another gig. But to me, it was something that I really had deep pride in setting up. And, you know, the William Morris Agency started booking a group. Their price began to go up gradually. There were no percentage deals back in those days, but we were doing shows, and the William Morris Agency was booking them, and, you know, it went from 750 to 1,000 to 1,200 to 1,500 or thereabouts. And, you know, after I Get Around, it went even, probably went to about 2 grand or give or take about that time. And yet, when I did shows with them, and we did them ourselves, and Murray fronted me the money for the hall and, you know, for the advertising that we had to buy it and all that, and we were walking away with $3,000, $6,000, $8,000, and the Morris Agency was still booking them for $2,000, $2,500. Wow. So, you know, it was a big difference when it was a Frederick Vale production, which is what I usually promoted as. Sometime I would let a local radio station front the concert, and it would be their name at the top of the bill. But a lot of them, including, you know, the famous recording session, December 21st, 63, was Frederick Vale Productions presents America's number one vocal instrumental group, the Beach Boys. Didn't have Fabulous on it. But, those were great days, and there was no infighting, and everybody was excited, and we were living for the moment, and, you know, and it was just, great times. Of course, Carl and Marx were still in school, and Alan had dropped out. You know, Mike was going through his first divorce, and Brian had not met Marilyn, and Al had not met Linda, and Carl had not met Annie, and Denny had not met Carol, and he hadn't met, you know, Barbara and all that, and, you know, I mean, these were different times. You know, kids would wear sport jackets and slacks, and the girls would wear dresses to concerts. I mean, it was a whole different era. You know, I often regret that I didn't.
In Chicago, I dressed that way. Not the skirt, but the sport coat and tie. So I remember
that. Well, that's the way it was back then. And, you know, it was a whole, they had respect for the acts, and, you know, it was really good looking back at that. I mean, I have a couple of regrets. You know, probably the biggest regret, even though May 24th, 1963, dramatically changed my life. It was the biggest singular business decision I ever made in my life. But I even looked back at that and I said, you know, that was a great thing doing that, you know, going to work for the Beach Boys. And, of course, nobody knew that they'd become the Beach Boys. They were just a group. And, I mean, and back in those days, Phil, you know, groups had shelf lives of only a couple of years. You know, I mean, everybody went through it. I mean, they weren't always, you know, they didn't last 5, 10 years, let alone 50 years. But, you know, so I just was lucky because I'd picked the Beach Boys and not the Astronauts or the Shantays or the Challengers or the Lively Ones or whatever. I mean, you know, the Beach Boys were certainly the right group to pick at the right time. But the one thing that I didn't do, and I regret, is that I didn't ask him for a contract. You know, had I been a businessman, like some of the promoters of that era, you know, I would have said, well, you know, yeah, I'd love to do it, but, you know, how about a contract, and how about giving me like 5% over the next 5 years or something like that? And I didn't, because the money wasn't a big deal. Money has never driven me, per se. It's paid bills. It gets me new equipment for the studio every once in a while. It pays for my daughter's shoes, you know, and go out to dinner and, you know, but money's never driven me. If money's your motivation, you know, that's so be it. But to me, it's never been about the money. It's being around being around great talent and creative people and being at the ground floor with a lot of groups, you know, not just the Beach Boys, which I'm certainly the most well-known for. I was also one of the very first, if not the first, to feature Glen Campbell in a concert at Sacramento again in 1964, October. In fact, the first gig he did for me, it was an all-night grad party, and I'd booked Ray Peterson, and Glenn and Ray were golfing buddies, and Ray and Glenn had met at, at the airport, and they were both booked into Sacramento. Ray was booked into a grad party by me, and Glenn was playing a country nightclub called the 40 Grand out in North Sacramento, which was really a, you know, just a joint, so to speak, and they were out playing a round of golf, and, you know, Ray happened to mention why he was up here, and he was doing this grad party for Fred Vail, and Glenn said, "Oh, I know Fred, he's a friend of the Beach Boys," and Ray said, "Yeah," and he said, "Man, can you get me on the show?" And he said, "Well, you know, I can call Fred," and he did, and, you know, of course, I'd already booked it, so I didn't have any funds, you know, we didn't have a budget, but Glenn said, "Well, I get off about 1 a.m. He said, "I'll just come over and, you know, play it and have fun and play for a bunch of kids." And I told him that'd be great. I said, "I can't pay anything, but love to have you drop by." So he came by the grad party and, you know, he had a guitar and a canvas case. It wasn't even a hard shell case. I remember that. It was all ripped up and everything. And he got up there and all he did was cover songs. You know, he did like Do I Could Do and Dang Me and Roger Miller type stuff, and
yeah,
you know, all these cover songs that he'd sung on demos and things, and that was it. And I told him, "Man, I'm sorry, man, I'm embarrassed that I can't pay you anything." "Hey, don't worry about it, I'm having fun." I said, "But I'll owe you one." That was June, I think that was around June. So in October, I was setting up a show for Jan and Dean, for Lou Adler and Jan Barry and Dean Torrance, and we were going to do a live album there because the Beach Boy album had already been successful. It already was in the top 10. I don't think it was quite gold, but it was doing really well. And so he decided he wanted to do a live album with Jan and Dean, which we did, and we did it at the Sacramento Auditorium. And I said, "Well, you can't lip sync, guys." But, you know, I used to hire Jan and Dean, and they would lip sync the records. Didn't carry a band. I mean, this was 62, 63. And I said, you know, we'll have to get a band if you're going to do a live album. I said, "Why don't you hire Glenn and Hal Blaine, and then we'll get Phil Sloan on keys, and we'll get Steve Barry on bass, and, you know, we'll put together, you know, a live group." And he thought that was a great idea, so I called Glenn. I said, "Glenn, I'm finally returning a favor. How about $200? You can come up and play the Jen and Dean concert." So he did. So I finally returned the favor.
Did that get recorded?
I'm sorry?
Did that show get recorded?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure it did. They took bits of that live concert along with the Tammy show outtakes, and they created their Command Performance album.
Command Performance, okay. They did a later one called Filet of Soul, but that was later on, I think.
No. It was Command Performance.
Yeah, so. Very cool.
So Fred, I promoted that one, and that was October 24th of 64. You know, so I've been, you know, I've managed to be there for a few moments. You know, I was there when Brian was writing Fun, Fun, Fun. I was with the group when they recorded it. I was with them on November 22nd, the night of the assassination of JFK, and played a gig in Marysville, Yuba City, at an auditorium there, and went back to the hotel. It was about 1 in the morning. We were all pretty wide awake because of the day. I mean, the president had been assassinated at 10 o'clock that morning. Here we'd done a show that evening, and we were back at the El Dorado Hotel, and it was relatively warm. We had the doors open, and like I said, we used to double and triple up in those days, and we were walking along the halls outside, and because it was more of a motel than a high-rise hotel, so you had outdoor corridors or walkways or balconies, whatever you want to do it. So we were out there, and we were going in and out of the rooms, and Murray and I had taken all the cash from the concert at the auditorium in Yuba City, Marysville, and we had them in shopping bags, you know, grocery bags, literally, and we had dumped them out on one of the beds, and I can vividly remember this cash, all these $1 bill, $5 bills, quarters on this bright turquoise blue bedspread, all this money piled up. Must have been $3,000 or $4,000 at least. And Brian and Mike were over in the corner on the other side of the other bed singing this song, you know, and working out parts, you know, the harmony parts and the arrangement. And I said, what are you guys working on? He said, oh, it's something we started in L.A. And he said, I think we've got it done. And that became The Warmth of the Sun. So I was there then. And, of course, I was there at the mastering of Pet Sounds at Capitol with Brian and sitting on a linoleum floor with my right shoulder against his left shoulder, listening to Pet Sounds be mastered. And, you know, it's a great moment. And dogs barking and the train whistle and drifting into the distance, and all of a sudden dead silence. It was completely dark in the room except for the pilot lights on the console and the VU meter lights and the little cutting lathe light that was over the cutting lathe so the engineer could see if it was tracking properly on the disc. Brian had asked him to turn the lights off, and the engineer looked at us like he was crazy, you know, but Brian had said it was too bright and he couldn't get into his, you know, thoughts. And, you know, would he turn out all the lights? So the guy had turned out all the lights, and there was just this little bit of illumination in the room. And mastering labs back then were literally technical facilities, Phil. I mean, they wore little white lab jackets and wore white gloves, and there was linoleum floors and acoustic ceiling and just a little console with maybe a couple of pieces of outboard gear to add compression or EQ. And Brian was telling him what to do while it was going on, and, you know, wouldn't it be nice, and all this, and all these songs, and God only knows, and Sloop John. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm the marketing guy, right? So I'm thinking, man, you've got at least four singles on this album for sure, you know. and it gets done, and the thing fades away, and it was just silent, you know. And Brian looks over at me, and he said, well, what do you think? And I said, man, strong album, Brian. I love it. It's really good. It's different. I love it. And he looked over at me again, and he said, Fred. And I said, yeah. And he said, what do you think the guys will think? Well, you know the story about that.
Right.
You know, there was Mike really questioned the album. Capitol Records questioned the album. And I basically told Brian, I said, Brian, I don't know what they'll think, but it's a great album, and I'm really proud of you, and I'll do all I can to, you know, help promote it. And of course, now we know how great of an album it truly was, you know, and so that was another great moment, right place, right time.
Yeah.
And,
Fred,
you know, there were a few more. The concerts
for
President and Mrs. Reagan in June of 83 at the White House, and I set that up. My contacts with, actually it was a benefit for Eunice Kennedy Shriver in the Special Olympics, and a friend of mine knew her and called me up and said they're going to have a big fundraiser in D.C. in June, and they're going to tie it into the kickoff of the premiere of Superman 3, and they're going to have Christopher Reeve there, and they're going to have all these celebrities there, and they'd like to see if the Beach Boys would play it. So I called Carl, and of course, right about that time, that was the famous James Watt, you know, not letting him play on the Mall, and because they
right.
might draw the wrong element. That was the famous, you know, James Watt, you know, faux pas. And President Reagan ended up giving him a gold foot with an arrow through it. And, but, you know, so I ended up setting that up, and I was there with him and that at that concert on the South Lawn of the White House. And as it turned out, and of course, I didn't know at the time, this is June of 83, that evening, after the White House afternoon show, which ended about 4:30, and, you know, Mike Love danced with Nancy Reagan, and then, you know, the president introduced him and all this stuff. Well, that night after that show, which was a big fundraiser for Special Olympics, they ended up going out to the George H.W. Bush's residence, the vice presidential residence, and doing a private show under a tent for him and Barbara. And I was invited, and he asked me to come to that, and I did. And as it turned out, you know, in George H.W. Bush, our future president, who was vice president then, he and the group sang Barbara Ann to Barbara Bush, who would become our future first lady. And I was there for that. And the main thing that I was there for, the sadness, you know, it was, again, one of those good news, bad news. The good news was that I was there when they did this historic performance. The bad news is it was the very, very last time that I would see the original Five Beach Boys on stage performing. Because 6 months later, my buddy T.W. was gone.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bittersweet memory for me. But, you know, to have gone from picking them up in a 54 Chevy wagon to limos and Lear jets to performing at the White House all in the span of, you know, 20 years was pretty phenomenal. You know,
Fred, let me ask you.
It's been a great ride.
Well, your stories are amazing. You've been great to them and with them. But one of the things that comes to my mind is every fan of any group or performer, you know, cares that music and all. But I just can't. It just seems to me that fans of the Beach Boys, true fans of the Beach Boys, just, it's like, it sounds corny, but we actually love them and care about them in ways way beyond just their music. Do you see that? Is that just doesn't seem typical? There's just something about them that draws you in.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, I think Leaf alluded to the fact. Now, that book, Beach Boys and the California Myth, came out in late 79, if I recall. I think it was 79. Right around then. And I remember him alluding to the fact that Fred Vail was one of the most loyal or the most loyal employee the Beach Boys ever had, you know. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, I probably am, quite honestly. I never ripped them off. I never stole from them. We're buddies. I'm still welcome in their homes. Their kids know me. You know, still welcome backstage. But I'll tell you, probably the reason for that is not only did I enjoy being with them and enjoy being a part of the early days and being a part of the legacy, even though a small part, but in reality, the reason why I've survived is because not only have I been a colleague and an associate and a former manager, but I've been a friend, but I've also been a fan. You know, I'm one of their biggest cheerleaders, and that comes through when I talk to you. And I just did a thing for a radio station, WBWC, in Cleveland, Ohio last week with Dennis King, and he does this Beach Boy Marathon every year, and I've been on it now for about 10, 12 years. And, you know, and I don't have to do these things, but I love doing them. You know, I love sharing them. And the Beach Boys had enormously loyal fans. I mean, there aren't too many groups out there who have fans that have been loyal for, you know, 50 years. Or, you know, and some of them came along a little bit later in life. But, you know, they weren't all there at the ground floor. But they've been with them for 20 years or 30 years. Some got introduced to the Beach Boys and Pet Sounds in 66. Some got introduced to them in the Capitol, the two record set that came out around 73, 74. Can't remember the title now. You know it.
Yeah, Endless Summer and Spirit
Endless
of
Summer.
America.
Yeah. And, you know, some got introduced to them in the 80s when they had a great touring group. And, you know, I mean, it's been a constant thing. But they've always had loyal fans. And I remember at one point we were at Ivar, which was the old office building, and it was just a door off of Hollywood Boulevard and Ivar Avenue, and we had this upstairs room, and eventually we were supposed to put a studio in it, but it had about 6,000 square feet of unfinished space that never got built out that we were supposed to put a studio in, and which I'm sure would have been where they would have recorded Sunflower and Holland and Surf's Up had they had it, but it never came to fruition. But, you know, we called it the tomb because it had absolutely no windows. But I remember we had a boardroom there, and where we'd have meetings of the group. And we had this entity at the time. It was called BBEE, Beach Boys Entertainment Enterprises, Inc. And that was kind of the forerunner of Brother Records. And we'd have these board meetings. And I remember there was a time, right about the time of Sunflower, and they hadn't had a hit. You know, if you call Bluebirds Over the Mountain a hit or Cottonfields a hit, then they had had a hit, but they hadn't had a major hit in a couple of years. And we were having this meeting, and it was like, I won't say it was finger-pointing, but they were all talking about, well, why aren't we popular anymore, was the bottom line. You know, why can't we seem to break through to these new audiences that are attracted to Hendrix and Big Brother and Mike Bloomfield and Moby Grape and all that, which they never really fit into per se. You know, what should we do? And if you look at photographs from that era, and one of the most famous ones I ended up helping set up, and we did it over at Capitol Records, and instead of them wearing the solid shirts or the striped shirts and the white pants and pretty well groomed, you know, they're all in leather jackets, and Al's twirling a whistle, and you know, they're starting to grow beards, and they're dressing differently and all that. It's like they're thinking, I know what they were thinking, you know, if we look like all these other groups, they'll accept us like all these other groups.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, no, you don't get it. You know, your core audience is much more loyal to you than that. You don't have to change. You know, politicians call it staying the course. And that's what I told them. I didn't have that terminology, you know, but I said, you know, don't give up your core audience. They will follow you. Just get through this period. Let's get all these other acts out of our system. They aren't going to last, you know, and they didn't, you know. And, you know, they became legends, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but they're dead, you know.
Right.
And it's like, stay the course. You know, your fans won't desert you. Well, they were too anxious, too eager, and, of course, they were, you know, looking for reasons and scapegoats, and they thought it was, you know, about the music, and it was about the staging and about the costumes, and, you know, that's the time that I left. Shortly thereafter, I left, and I was just not willing to see him self-destruct, and, you know, and Holland was a financial disaster, and the guys began to point fingers at each other, and you know, I just couldn't deal with it. I didn't want to see it going on. I was too close to them. I mean, Denny and CW and I were really like brothers. We had lived with each other. I'd stayed in their homes. I'd bounce their kids on my lap. I'd been so much a part of it that, you know, I just had too much emotion going on, and it really kind of tore me apart to see him almost to the point of self-destruction. I mean, that's almost what it came to. And I knew that they deserved more, and I knew that it wasn't their fault that Sunflower and Add Some Music weren't huge hits. It was just timing and Warner Brothers, who didn't have a vested interest in them, to really get behind them 110% and fight for them at radio. And, you know, it's just a lot of, again, timing and circumstances. But it was... I tell people, Ivar and that whole era, it was kind of like the Dickens Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And I saw both of them up close and in person. And there was tremendous creativity. The boys were starting to step out and away from the shadow of BW, and they were starting to write their own songs. And, of course, you know, the Sunflower album opens with DW's song, you know, and I think Forever is one of the great tracks on the album. You know, Carl's starting to write, and Al is stepping out, and I mean, you know, it was Bruce is in the group now, and you know, it was a unique, challenging time, and a lot of bad things going on, but at the same time, there was a lot of greatness that came out of that era, also. You know, so I've, you know, been kind of with them and through the thick and the thin, and you know, I think I told the story a few times. I know I told it on the first volume of the Brian Wilson DVD, Brian Wilson Songwriter, 1962-1969, and I'm sure you've seen that. And
I have, yes.
There's an emotional story there that I was on the road promoting Add Some Music, and I came into Philadelphia, and I went by WFIL, which was AM station then, you know, top 40, and AM was still the happening format, and most of the album-oriented rock was on FM, and the top 40 was on AM, and you know, so you'd call on AM stations for the most part, and that was their, the core Beach Boy audience was listening to top 40 radio, and you know, WNEW in New York, and there were a few others that were playing the Beach Boys. Pete Fornatel, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago, was a huge fan of theirs, and Rick Sklar and Paul Muni and all these guys, but I mean, it was an AM world still for singles, and so I went to FIL, just like I'd go to KHJ or I'd go to WRKO in Boston and, you know, going to all these different radio stations around the country that are playing top 40 music and take the record in. And, you know, it was really hard to pick up any of the mainstream AM major market stations. I'd get secondary markets, but I couldn't pick up a lot of big AM mainstream stations. So I was at FIL and I went in to see Jay Cook, who was the program director there, who is a legendary program director, and here he is at a legendary radio station, because WFIL is where Dick Clark went to work, where they launched American Bandstand, and, you know, I'd come home as a kid every afternoon and 4 o'clock turn on ABC to listen to Dick Clark's American Bandstand and see what the kids are rating records and see what they're dancing and see what kind of clothes they're wearing, and, you know, there's no CMT, there's no VH1, there's no MTV, I mean, this is how you saw your artist, and a lot of times you were introduced to them, you saw them for the first time on American Bandstand. You know, they were just voices on the radio. Buddy Holly was a voice, you know. Elvis was a voice. Of course, you occasionally saw him on a TV show, but for the most part, a lot of the up-and-coming groups, like the Leslie Gores and the Dion and the Belmonts and, you know, the Fabians and that, you didn't know what they were like until a magazine came out that might feature them. So you saw them on American Bandstand. And so here I am walking into the lobby of WFIL, a legendary radio station, a legendary television station, and since I was manager of the Beach Boys, you know, I kind of got pushed to the head of the line and was able to go in and see Jay Cook before a lot of the record promotion guys visited with him, and of course, he was eager to see me, and because he's a huge Beach Boy Brian Wilson fan, we ended up talking about 20 minutes about Brian and the Boys and how he thought Brian was a true creative genius. You know, we've heard that story so many, many, many times before, which is true, but, you know, we've all heard it. And, you know, so he was talking about Brian and he said, I was at a little radio station in Podunk when the Beach Boys first launched and I've kind of grown up with their music and, you know, they're great and all that. And, you know, we did this for about 15, 20 minutes, just chit chat. And he's got all these gold records on the wall and you know, finally, it's time, in the sales lingo, it's time to call for the order, which means it's time to cut bait, you know, or fish or cut bait, and it's time to ask them to play the record, you know. And so I said, you know, well, Jay, we got this new single out, and we're at a new label, Warner Brothers, and we've got this album coming out shortly, and the first single, lead-off single, is called Add Some Music, and you know, he plays it, and I said, you know, I need to have you guys get on it. Well, I knew if WFIL blessed that record by adding it, or if Jay Cook blessed that record by adding it, then tons of secondary stations along the East Coast, the Harrisburgs and the Troys and the Trenton, New Jerseys, and all these other stations and would play the record, you know. And, you know, it even might have even opened the record up for D.C. or for maybe even got lucky New York City, because all of a sudden WFIL is playing this record. It could give me a bullet in Billboard magazine. And I said, you know, can you play the Beach Boy record? And he looked at me and he said, no, Fred, I can't play it. And it was like, I was devastated. it was part of me. I was crushed. You know, and I said, well, Jay, you just got done telling me about growing up with the Beach Boys and how you've loved their music since the early 60s and how you, you know, love Brian and how he's a creative genius. And he said, Fred, all that's true, but he said, I can't play it. And I said, why? And he said, Fred, the Beach Boys aren't hip anymore.
Wow.
What? Well, as I tell so many audiences, I said, that's the one thing about being a Beach Boy diehard, because we always win. We win out in the end, because WFIL is a thing of the past. I think it's either all Christian or all Spanish now. Jay Cook is gone. I mean, literally passed away. But here we are, 50 years later, every moment of every day, 24/7, somebody in this world is going to a Beach Boy concert, singing along to a Beach Boy song on a radio, oldie station, listening to a Beach Boy song on a commercial, listening to a Beach Boy song on a soundtrack of a motion picture. And he said in 1970 that the Beach Boys aren't hip anymore.
Wow.
Wow.
Fred, you have given us a treasure trove of archival stories behind stories, and I know you're just scratching the surface. I want to thank you for taking such a big chunk of time to, well, for true Beach Boy fans, this is just, you know, I haven't interrupted you because I just wanted to keep hearing you talk, and I appreciate every.
I'll tell you something, Phil. I did it last week when I talked to Dennis King and Cleveland. I do it every year, and I just did it probably three or four times. I get really emotional. Get emotional about the Jay Cook story. I get emotional about thinking about what true incredible talents we lost with Carl and DW.
Yes.
And it's like therapy. It's like I did it DVD with the that they filmed here. And I just did a part two of that, by the way. I don't think it's been edited and released yet, but they're doing another Brian Wilson songwriter DVD.
Right.
And I did that. Can't remember when I did it. Let's see. I think it was sometime around November, December, if I recall. It's, as far as I know, it's not out. But, man, I get emotional about these things. It's in one way, it's therapy.
Sure.
And in another, it's like incredible emotion, you know, because, you know, I haven't seen the tour yet. I'm going to catch it. I don't know. Like I said, I may see it tomorrow in Cincinnati, which is June 12th, is, you know, today's the 11th. You know, I may see it maybe if I go out to Tahoe in July. At some point, I'm going to see it, and I'm going to see those two portions of the show where they have got clips of Denny and clips of Carl and singing God Only Knows and Forever. And I know it's going to knock me out, man. It's going to be so emotional. But, you know, I just, when I spoke at the, I emceed the California Landmark Ceremony out in Hawthorne in 2005 when they, gave the former, well, the site of the Wilson residence, they made it a California State Historical Landmark. And, of course, the house had been torn down for a number of years, and
right.
I'd been at the guest at that house a number of times and been in that music room where they created some of their early music and, you know, been in the kitchen where the family had so many meals. And, you know, it was kind of weird, like, speaking, and I ended up emceeing the event from start to finish and getting it and ultimately introduced, you know, Brian and, you know, introduced four freshman member that just passed away in the last few months was a special guest. Trying to remember Bob.
Bob is first name?
Bob, what's his last name? Kim's with an F.
Forgetting too.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I forgot his last name as well.
Yeah, my mind's a blank. Not Ferguson. It's oh, I should know this. Anyway, you know, he was there and saluted Brian and was honored that Brian should look to the four freshmen for his inspiration, his early inspiration. So he was there, and I introduced, you know, Billy had this group that he was trendsetter or tripsetter that he was involved with at the time they performed, and the mayor of Hawthorne and all these different people and TV cameras and all were there. And when I did my opening remarks, and, you know, I said that, you know, had I been alive in the 1800s, I might have been lucky enough to work with Stephen Foster.
Ah.
And had I been alive in the early 1900s, I might have had a chance to work with George Gershwin or Cole Porter or maybe Irving Berlin. And I said, but you know what? I was lucky. I grabbed the gold, what do you call it, the gold ring on the Ferris wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to work with Brian Wilson. So.
Well, I know I'm a bit subjective because I'm a Beach Boy fan. I love the Beatles music, but I think 50 years from now, Beach Boy Brian Wilson music will be, I'm not sure what word to use, much more respected, honored, recognized. I'm trying to put Beatle music down, but I just...
No, I know. He will be. I mean, he is...
It's longer
the
last.
Cole Porter, the Irving Berlin, the George Gershwin of our generation.
Yeah.
And it's nothing that I love more than going to a show. I remember specifically a couple of years ago I went to see Mike and Bruce in Kentucky, Ashland, Kentucky. It was a downtown Merchants Association. It was a free concert. It was put on by this Merchants Association. I got there early and ended up having dinner with Bruce and got together with, you know, the guys and went to the show, and it was along a riverbank and it was packed. It was standing room only. It was like 35,000-40,000 people, I think, were there. And I'm standing there in the audience, which is, you know, even though I have backstage passes, ultimately I like ending up in the audience because that's where I get to see the show. I get to see
sure.
the interaction with the audience. I get to see the people and, you know, their faces. And here I am standing there, and right in front of me is what is obviously a grandfather with his son to his side and his grandkid on his shoulders. And all three of them are singing along to Bob Rayan and Fun, Fun, Fun.
Yeah. Well,
there's no better than that. You know, I remember about, I guess it was 2001, 2002, Brian went on tour with, they did the Pet Sounds tour. And there were a half a dozen cities, maybe not even that many, where they actually appeared with the symphony of that city.
I was at the Chicago show.
Okay, well, I was at the one in Detroit at Pine, what used to be Pine Knob, which was a amphitheater outdoor venue up north of downtown Detroit in near Michigan Hills and Troy. And the Beach Boys used to play it, you know, when the Nederlander family owned it. And it was always one of the gigs you look forward to. And there were always thousands of kids there and have many memories of, you know, being there. And so that's where I go. And because they were going to do Atlanta, but it wasn't going to be with an orchestra. They were going to do, I think they were going to do Birmingham or Montgomery or somewhere, but it didn't end up coming off with the orchestra. So I wanted to see them. My daughter was like 3 years old. We decided to go to Detroit to see him at what used to be Pine Knob. And I got there. Leaf was going to be there. And, you know, it was going to be like old home week. And you know, Jeffrey and all the guys and the Wondermans, who are incredible, you know, incredible guys and have great respect for BW and his music. And I remember I got there just as the orchestra was doing the, you know, the opening overture. They were doing like orchestra, you know, instrumental versions of some
right.
of the big hit records. It was the pre-concert kind of thing. And then after they, and it's great hearing, you know, songs like Fun, Fun, Fun and God Only Knows with strings. I mean, it's fabulous. So they had done the overture, and then Brian had come out to do a short set, and then there was an intermission, and then after the intermission, they come back out with the orchestra and Brian's group, and they do this, you know, Pet Sounds front to back, you know, and I was the first guy to hear it front to back at the studio at the basement of Capitol Records when I went to the mastering with Brian. And during that break, during that intermission, I had gone out to get a soda. And I don't think there were only maybe, to be kind, I would say there might have been 3,000 people there. It was sparse in the seated area, you know, the good seats, and then it was, you know, people would bring the blankets and the lawn chairs and sit on the hill. You know, there were a bunch of those. It was probably about half and half. But I doubt there were 2,000 or 3,000 people there. I doubt. And so I'm going to get a soda, and I'm going to the concession stand and got my drink, and I'm walking back to the seats. And we were perfect, like dead center, about 15 rows back. It was great seats, perfect, you know. I don't like to be too close because you don't really get the full sound. And I don't like to be too far back because you can't see the expressions on the players and BW. But, you know, it was perfect. So I'm going back to my seat, and I stop at this concession stand, and this guy that was selling cotton candy or something. And I said, well, not a whole lot of people here tonight. Is it always like this? And he said, oh, no, sir. And he's about 19 years old. He said, about a week and a half ago, we had Britney Spears here, and there was like 19,000 people. And I said, oh. And he said, oh, about a week before that, the Ozfest came, and we had over 20,000 people. I said, oh, you know, and so I go back to my seat and sitting down with my wife, Debbie, and my daughter, and they come on and they start doing Pet Sounds, and everybody's singing along. And then when they do the encore and they're doing Bob Rahan and Surfing USA and Fun, and I'm trying to remember, Love and Mercy, I think they used to do on the encore. And everybody's singing along to like every song and smiles and, you know, two or three generations in the audience. And I'm thinking to myself, well, Brian got the last laugh again.
Yeah.
I said,
yeah.
How many people are going to be here and how many people are going to be singing along to all those great hits of Ozzy Osbourne and Britney Spears 25, 35, 45 years from now? Ain't gonna happen. Beach Boys get the last laugh.
Fred, those will have to be our last words. You have more than been kind to spend all this time sharing what I know, not just your career and your business, but Beach Boys became friends, even family, and I know a lot of us fans, anyone who's stayed through this podcast all the way to this point is like me.
They're either going to sleep.
No. Anybody who's stuck with this, we like you for reasons I cannot fully fathom. Love those guys. I had a chance to say that to them in the sound check time in Chicago. And there's just something very special, spiritual, and touching about them. Fred, you too. Thanks for all these stories of the backstories. And maybe we can do another podcast sometime because I know that your archive.
Oh, yeah. We haven't gotten into my two parted brothers, you know, and there's all that, and there's all these stories about when they were writing these songs and going to these sessions, and, you know, because I was there for the Good Vibration recording. I mean, how do you top that? I mean, I have a studio now, and I've had it for 32 years, and we've had our share of moments. We had the number one selling country album in 2011, and Jason Aldean, My Kind of Party, has had 5 number ones, and that's a great deal of pride for me. Waylon Jennings cut his last studio album here before he passed, and Johnny Cash cut here, and Dolly, and all these other artists. But I still treasure, you know, the Beach Boy memories. But, you know, there's tons of other stories. I mean, we could go on all night, you know, but we'll put it aside for right now. And let me know when you post this, and I'd love to.
Will do.
Listen to. I might not listen to it front to back because I've lived it, but I'd like to see what the sound quality was like and see what some of your listeners may have posted. Because,
well,
you know, I've been honored to be a part of this whole thing, and truly, truly honored. It's been a huge, huge, made a huge impact, obviously, on my life. I can trace back just about everything, all the major turning points in my life, and that first May 24th concert that we spoke about was really the beginning. I mean, that was really where it all really started, and everything else it just kind of followed and transgressed from one, you know, thing to another. But you know, I'm just glad that I was there, and I'm glad that I'm still here. So I thank you for wanting to hear my words, and I'll look forward to our next one.
That sounds good. Don't hang up yet, but thanks so much. I think a lot of people only know you as that voice introducing them, but hopefully they're getting a
sense. Yeah, and I hope I get to do that somehow or another this year. I wrote
Fosquette,
and I said, is there any concert coming up that, you know, that don't have a host or don't have an MC or aren't sponsored? And I said, I'd love to bring them on one more time. I said, that would be absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, that would be great. Going to end the recording. Don't hang up yet, though.